Welcome to today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Wednesday, April 24th, 2024. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik, and here is our first story. It's entitled, High Hopes for Q Casino Hotel. Officials break ground on $47 million tower. It's written by Grace Nealand of the Telegraph Herald. Project leaders have begun construction on a key portion of an $83 million renovation project at a Dubuque casino. Casino leaders, elected officials, and area residents alike gathered Tuesday at Q Casino and Resort for a ceremonial groundbreaking on what will become a seven-story boutique hotel tower adjacent to the casino. Around 150 people attended the celebration, where updated floor plans and branding were announced for the hotel. The hotel, named Key Hotel, will include 90 guest rooms as well as rooftop restaurant and bar, and is expected to open in the fall of 2025. Today has been a long time coming, Q Casino and Resort President and CEO Alex Dixon said. We're here to celebrate another phase of our overall renovation and expansion efforts, one that will change the very skyline of Dubuque. Construction of the $47 million hotel is one of several phases wrapped into Q Casino and Resort's planned $83 million renovation and expansion plan, Dixon said. Other improvements include an ongoing revamp of the casino's interior and its new branding strategy. A new Q Casino and Resort gaming area is expected to open over the Memorial Day weekend, Dixon said, and an all-ages family entertainment zone will follow later this year with amenities including duck pin bowling, digital axe throwing, and arcade games. The hotel project also complements ongoing development on and around Chaplin Schmidt Island, where city and casino leaders hope to construct an amphitheater by the summer of 2026. It takes many people across a variety of disciplines to bring this to life, remarked Q Casino and Resort Chief Operating Officer Stacy Kansky. Many people have been demonstrating unwavering work and support on the plans for this project. Planned improvements are being completed in conjunction with DRA, the nonprofit license holder for Dubuque's two casinos, said DRA Board Chair Mike Donahue. Any increase in casino revenue generated by the upgrades would result in an increase in the funds allocated from DRA to the city and to local nonprofits through the DRA's annual grant awards. Various city and county leaders attended the groundbreaking Tuesday to celebrate that partnership and its benefit for the tri-state area at large. This is what partnership really looks like, Dubuque Mayor Brad Kavanaugh said. This island right here is a gateway to Iowa. We want people to come across that bridge and see what this is and start to see what this city truly has to offer. The hotel will be part of a Hilton Hotel and Resort's Tapestry Collection, a collection of independent hotels that aim to mirror the communities in which they operate. Even the name Key Hotel was selected as a nod to Dubuque's classic Key City moniker. Hilton's Director of Owner Relations, Danielle Linkaus, said the hotel tower was designed as a shared vision between Hilton and Dubuque area leaders with the goal of creating lodging with a distinctively Dubuque atmosphere. The rooftop bar and restaurant will overlook the Mississippi River, Linkaus added, highlighting one of the city's key economic and tourism drivers. I'm ready to see this project come to life, she said. Reflecting the city of Dubuque, the Key Hotel will enhance the existing offerings of the Q Casino and Resort by introducing a distinct personality to travelers and locals alike. While Tuesday's groundbreaking mostly was symbolic, construction soon will begin on the project in earnest. Project leaders closed on the financing late last week, Dixon said, and Conlon Construction has been contracted for the construction. Bottom line, we're forging ahead, Dixon said. There's so much more to come, and I'm very excited about what the future holds. Next up is a story entitled, Teenagers Bring Science to Kitchen. Wallert students design and install a sustainable hydroponic system for Grand River Center. This is written by Elizabeth Kelsey of the Telegraph Herald. When Wallert Catholic High School senior Grace Schroeder learned earlier this year that she would be responsible for pitching a sustainable agricultural project to a local business, she was initially a bit nervous. But on Tuesday, as Grace gazed at the trays of microgreen plants she and her classmates helped grow for Grand River Center in Dubuque, she was proud of what the group had accomplished. You don't have to be an adult that has your own establishment to work with a business, Grace said. Grace is one of four Wallert students in teacher Corin Shriver's environmental sciences class who recently worked with Grand River Center to design and build a hydroponic system for growing microgreens in the center's kitchen. The system, which Grand River Center staff plan to maintain and expand, is designed to provide the event center with a sustainable on-site food source to supplement its menus. I learned that sustainability and business don't have to be opposites, Grace said. They can work together. Ray Milhalik, Grand River Center's food and beverage director and executive chef, said he had wanted to bring microgreens to the center for some time. After searching for local farms that could help, he found Shriver, who, in addition to her teaching position at Wallert, also runs Re-Evolution Farms in Dubuque with her family. The sustainable urban farm offers both soil-grown produce and microgreens grown through hydroponics. Shriver and Milhalik quickly realized that the microgreens project at the Grand River Center could be perfect for the Shriver's students. We have a sustainability focus in this environmental science class, Shriver said. We do a variety of projects, both in the fall and spring, and the students also do their own capstone project where they're working on the research and design process, so this piggybacks on a lot of the skills they're working on. The students conducted research on hydroponic systems, developed a design proposal for how the microgreen system would work, and in February presented it to Milhalik and his team. Without them, this wouldn't be happening at all, Milhalik said. They did all the research. They brought us the shopping list. All we had to do was buy everything, and then they came in and set it all up. Grand River Center used funds from a $1,370 Sustainable Dubuque grant approved by city council members earlier this month to purchase the materials for the microgreen system. The Wallert students were tasked with constructing and installing the system. The setup includes a water filtration system that reuses the water in which the plants are grown, something Senior Connor Healy said involved plenty of problem solving. We had to figure out the right measurements for things. For example, cutting out the exact right size hole for the hose to go through it and work properly, he said. The students also planted the first round of microgreens, which included broccoli, daikon, radish, and rambo radish microgreens. On Tuesday, the plants had been growing for about 2 weeks and were ready for harvest. Milhalik planned to use them as part of the menus for the Growing Sustainable Communities Conference taking place at the Grand River Center Tuesday and today. Moving forward, Milhalik said his staff will take responsibility for planting, tending, and harvesting the microgreens. I'd like to use them in a lot of salads, he said. They're also beautiful to garnish with, and, hopefully, we can move on to lettuce, microgreens, and some other plants I'd like to try as we get going. The Wallert students and Shriver were slated to speak at the Growing Sustainable Communities Conference on Tuesday. Shriver said they would discuss the microgreen system as well as the collaboration between Re-Evolution Farms and Holy Family Catholic Schools to create educational opportunities in unused spaces in Dubuque. The farm, which is housed on a former baseball field in the city's north end, also serves as an outdoor classroom for an urban agriculture class Shriver teaches at Wallert. Grand River Center General Manager Ryan Boniface said officials with Oakview Group, which operates the center, view the microgreens system as the first of many sustainability-focused projects they intend to implement. This has just been a match made in heaven with Re-Evolution and Wallert, and our intention is to grow and expand this, he said. And our final story from the front page of the Telegraph Herald today is entitled Officials Eager for Behavioral Health Overhaul. Pending Reynolds' signature, bill would combine two state systems and create 7 health districts. It's written by Benjamin Fisher. Local leaders said they are optimistic about a bill awaiting Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds' signature to merge the state systems overseeing mental health and disability services and substance use treatment services. The Iowa legislature last week passed a broad reorganization of state behavioral health supports that would combine the state's current 13 mental health/disability service regions and 19 substance use provider networks into 7 behavioral health districts across the state. Reynolds proposed some of the bill's measures at the start of the legislative session. The merging of the two systems would create more flexibility for funding that previously was restricted to one type of service or the other. The bill would give the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services authority to appoint an administrative service organization for each district, which could be either a public agency like those currently managing the mental health/disability services regions and substance use networks, or a private nonprofit. Districts' governing boards would serve in an advisory capacity and would be made up of more stakeholders, local constituents, health professionals, and law enforcement than local elected officials. The bill passed with broad bipartisan support, 88-8 in the House, 42-5 in the Senate. All lawmakers representing Clayton, Delaware, Dubuque, and Jackson counties voted in favor of the bill in their chambers. While the bill would mean major changes, local officials said Tuesday that they were optimistic about its impacts. There are still certainly opportunities for evolution and innovation in the MH/DS system in Iowa, said May Hington, CEO of Mental Health/Disability Services of the East Central Region. Getting there for the next year or two will likely just include a lot of work as we transition from one style of management to a different style, as well as pulling in different services. Dubuque County Supervisor Ann McDonough, who serves as her county's representative on the East Central Region Governing Board, highlighted the long-sought chance to access both mental health/disability services funding and substance use treatment funding. I think we'll see things looked at more holistically, from early childhood all the way through disabilities in adults to our seniors, she said. This allows us to treat substance use and substance abuse disorder all together. Rarely do we see someone with brain health issues who does not also have substance use issues. It's all one coin with two sides. I think it makes sense to treat them together, as this would allow. Hinkin shared McDonough's relief in the bill breaking down the state's silos between mental health and substance services, provided the state gives the new districts enough leeway. We truly hope that we get the opportunity to integrate care, that it's not just the administrative service organization taking over the contracting for the substance use block grant, Hinkin said. Yes, we're happy to administer those contracts, but we really want to work toward more innovation because it will be freed up in the law for us to integrate care so it's more seamless for a person experiencing both brain health and substance use issues. They could go to one place and get services where it's not one provider specializing in brain health and one specializing in substance use. That's something we've been working on for years. Hinkin acknowledged that the East Central Region would not necessarily be the new Behavioral District's administrative services organization. Delaware County Supervisor Shirley Helmricks, her county's representative on the East Central Region Governing Board, said local healthcare officials approve of the bill's potential funding flexibility. Looking at brain health with substance abuse, the people at the hospital are definitely looking forward to that, she said, because we have area substance abuse counsel, but we only have them sometimes 2 days a week and sometimes only 1 day a week. Lawmakers critical of the bill during Senate debate raised concerns about whether current region's past innovations would be able to continue under the new system. Lawmakers were concerned whether rural counties would be able to keep services currently funded by their regions when they are merged into fewer, larger districts that possibly include more populous counties. Democrats criticized that there would be no additional state funding for mental health associated with the behavioral health overhaul. Helmricks voiced some apprehension about bigger districts and less local government authority, but also said Delaware County had been served well by the current large region. We'll most likely have 18 counties, she said. Sometimes bigger isn't always better in my mind. When we became the region of 9 counties and everybody had the same services, 3 large counties and 6 small counties, each with the same vote, we've all had really good MH/DS services. I'm hoping we'll see that same type of thing, but we don't know. McDonough acknowledged that she would have less direct authority as a supervisor under the bill's provisions, but said there could be more opportunities with the larger districts to learn best practices and share efforts and resources for mental health services in juvenile detention centers, among other things. If Reynolds signs the bill, district boundaries would be announced by August 1st. The state would have until December 31st to choose districts' administrative services organizations. Now from the Dubuque and Tri-State page, we've got an article entitled Iowa to Recognize Dubuquer for Years-Long Volunteer Efforts. Retired 911 dispatcher has aided Hills and Dales and the Irish Hooli. This is written by Eric Hogstrom of the Telegraph Herald. Vicki Leonard's years-long dedication to her life's passions is about to be recognized statewide. A retired Dubuque County 911 dispatcher who has organized a gift-giving tradition for Hills and Dales residents for the past 25 years, Leonard will be inducted into the Iowa Volunteer Hall of Fame on Tuesday, April the 30th in Des Moines. "We are really thrilled," said Deanne Althoff, Mission Advancement and Community Relations Director for Hills and Dales. "Vicki is the perfect recipient for the honor. She is deeply committed and so humble about what she does, not only with Hills and Dales, but the other organizations she is involved with." Leonard, age 65, began her career as a 911 dispatcher in 1975, shortly after her graduation from Wallert Catholic High School. She retired 13 years ago, but maintains close ties to local first responders and law enforcement. "She has always given more than 100%, said Dubuque County Emergency Communications Director Jessica George Rethwish. "That woman just doesn't stop." George Rethwish said Leonard helps plan fundraising dinners and provides St. Christopher medals for new law enforcement officers and firefighters. "The medals are a popular symbol of protection and guidance. She's very much involved in a lot of things," George Rethwish said. Leonard and her husband, Pat, have been involved in Dubuque's Irish community for many years and are among the organizers of the annual Irish Hooli event. "They never take a break from planning that," George Rethwish said of Pat and Vicki Leonard's Irish Hooli commitments. More than 25 years ago, Leonard began coordinating the gift-giving tradition at Hills and Dales, a Dubuque nonprofit serving people with disabilities. First responders, law enforcement personnel, firefighters, and other emergency services workers provide Christmas gifts for each of the 59 children and adults living at Hills and Dales. During the past 2.5 decades, current and retired members of the Dubuque area's emergency services have donated nearly 5,000 gifts to center residents and donated more than $150,000 to Hills and Dales. Leonard also coordinates efforts to raise money for Hills and Dales through events such as a community chili cook-off event. "What really stands out for me is what we don't just hear from Vicki once a year at Christmas," Althoff said. "She's a constant advocate for us throughout the year, whether it is something big to do with an overall organizational need or if it is one resident with a special need. We know we could call her and she would work individually or she would rally her troops and get something figured out to meet that need." Leonard said she was humbled and floored when she received news of her upcoming recognition. She also said she is not alone in her work. "It's never about one person when you volunteer," Leonard said. "It's about the whole village of people." Our next story from this page is entitled DA Clears Deputies Officer of Wrongdoing. Lafayette County official points to lawful and reasonable acts during arrest of man who died. This is written by Grace Neeland of the Telegraph Herald and dateline is Schulzburg, Wisconsin. Two Lafayette County deputies and a Darlington police officer have been cleared of any criminal wrongdoing after a Schulzburg man died while being taken into custody. Lafayette County District Attorney Jenna Gill found that involved officers engaged in lawful and reasonable acts of defense of self and others during the February 12th arrest of 44-year-old Gregory A. Marcotti. As such, no criminal charges will be filed, according to a news release from the Lafayette County Sheriff's Department. The decision comes after Gill received findings from an investigation into the incident from the Wisconsin Department of Justice. Marcotti died after officers arrested him in the early morning hours of February the 12th along West Water Street in Schulzburg, documents state. Authorities responded to the scene for a report of a man acting erratically and upon arrival found Marcotti yelling in the street. GOJ reports list the officers involved in the initial response as Lafayette County Sheriff's Department Deputy Jarrett Lancaster, Lafayette County Sheriff's Department Corporal David Mullen, and Darlington Police Officer Nicholas Manch. Footage from officers' body cameras, which was included with the DOJ's report, shows Marcotti shouting at officers multiple times after their arrival. Marcotti did not respond to officers' inquiries or demands, and footage shows him repeatedly stating he was on drugs. Footage then shows Marcotti approaching Manch in what Manch later told investigators was a threatening manner, documents state. Manch told Marcotti to stop, otherwise he would be tased. Marcotti continued to approach, and Manch deployed his taser. It struck the left side of Marcotti's body with little effect, documents state. Manch deployed his taser a second time, but told investigators that deployment missed Marcotti. Footage then shows Marcotti turning to Mullen and shoving him, at which point an on-scene acquaintance of Marcotti's stepped in and tried to calm him down. Documents state the pair ended up on the ground after Marcotti grabbed the other man's shoulder, and the deputies and Manch approached to subdue Marcotti while he was still on the ground. They struggled to subdue Marcotti for 2 to 3 minutes before ultimately securing him in handcuffs, documents state. Shortly after, officers realized he was unresponsive and flipped him onto his back to begin life-saving measures. Emergency medical personnel arrived on the scene, and Marcotti was taken to an area hospital where he was pronounced dead within an hour of his arrival. An autopsy included in the DOJ's investigative report lists Marcotti's cause of death as sudden death. All additional information was redacted. A post-mortem toxicology report also was completed on Marcotti, but that information, too, was redacted in the report released to the public. Attempts to contact the DOJ and Gill on Tuesday for additional information were not immediately successful. Lancaster, Mullen, and Manch were put on administrative leave pending the DOJ's investigation per their department's policies for officer-involved deaths. After Gill's determination that no wrongdoing occurred, all three have since been reinstated to their full duties. Now here's some short articles from under the News in Brief heading. First, authorities say three hurt in Joe Davies County crash following chase. The dateline is East Dubuque, Illinois. Authorities said three people were injured Monday in a crash near East Dubuque following an attempted traffic stop and a high-speed chase. Joseph Oyman, 21, of Barneveld, Wisconsin, was transported to Midwest Medical Center in Galena, Illinois, while Levi Brown, age 21, also of Barneveld, and an unarmed male juvenile were transported to Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center for treatment of their injuries, according to the Joe Davies County Sheriff's Department. A press release states that about 8:20 p.m. Monday, Galena police attempted to conduct a traffic stop on a vehicle near South Main and Water Streets in Galena. The vehicle fled from the officers at a high rate of speed, traveling down Water Street, north on Franklin Street, and west on U.S. 20. Galena police ended the pursuit at the intersection of U.S. 20 and U.S. 84 north with regard to the public's and officers' safety, and the vehicle last was seen traveling north on Menominee Road. At about 8:30 p.m., the Joe Davies County Sheriff's Department 911 Center received an iPhone crash detection alert from North Menominee Road just south of Route 5 West. The release states that deputies learned the driver of the vehicle, Oyman, failed to negotiate a left turn, hit a mailbox, became airborne, struck a utility pole, rolled several times, and came to rest in a driveway. Oyman was cited with failure to reduce speed to avoid a crash, illegal transportation of cannabis as a driver, and driving under the influence of drugs. Next, Dubuque leaders to host community development forum. The city of Dubuque invites area residents to a business and community development forum set for next week. Greater Dubuque Development Corp. staff will facilitate the event, which will begin at 5:30 p.m. Tuesday, April the 30th at Northeast Iowa Community College's Town Clock Business Center in Dubuque, 680 Main Street. The event will include a brief review of the city's previous roundtable discussions with developers, followed by a review of the recent business and economic development process improvements, a review of the city's budget, and an update on the city's design review team. The forum is part of an ongoing process to discuss and propose measures to improve the process for development in Dubuque. It follows a public input meeting hosted last October that was preceded by a series of private meetings between area developers and city staff. Attendees are asked to reserve their spot online at tinyurl.com/dbqround or by contacting GDDC Executive Assistant Anna Roiling at annar@greaterdubuque.org or at area code 563-557-9049. And reality show winning trio to perform in Dubuque. Three siblings who made history on television's The Voice will appear in concert in Dubuque. Girl Named Tom will perform August 18th at Five Flags Center, according to a press release from the venue. Becca Grace Lacey, Joshua Lacey, and Caleb Lacey won season 21 of The Voice, becoming the first trio to win the competition. The trio's music includes covers of Dust in the Wind, River, and The Chain. Tickets are available beginning at 10 a.m. Friday, April the 26th at the Five Flags Center box office or online at Ticketmaster.com. Now it's time to move on to the opinion page, and we've got an Other View written by Kim Hubers, who is a service-disabled South Dakota Army National Guard veteran of the Iraq War. She's a life member of DAV, commander of DAV Chapter 1 in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and a member of the DAV Interim Women's Veterans Advisory Committee. In 2023, she was named DAV's Disabled American Veteran of the Year for her dedicated service to veterans. And the title of her Other View is VA Congress Can Save Veterans' Lives. When I dreamed of joining the military, I knew it wouldn't be an easy dream to realize. I knew I'd have to push myself past my limits and that I could be required to risk my life. Over my 14 years in the South Dakota Army National Guard, including service in Iraq, all of that and more came to fruition. But I failed to predict what would be the most difficult parts of service. They came after I took off the uniform, after war wreaked havoc on my body. They were the experiences of being dismissed and feeling misunderstood by the very system that promised to take care of me, the Department of Veterans Affairs. While every veteran will inevitably face challenges navigating an imperfect system, women veterans have historically been overlooked and underserved by the VA. Much progress has been made in recent decades, but with lives at stake, it's not enough. According to the VA, between 2020 and 2021, the suicide rate among women veterans jumped 24.1%, nearly four times higher than the 6.3% increase among male veterans. The reasons for the staggering rate of suicide among women veterans are being uncovered by Disabled American Veterans in its new report, Women Veterans: The Journey to Mental Wellness. DAV takes a deep dive into the unique factors that put women veterans at risk of suicide and the VA's failures to appropriately address those factors. Armed with this information, DAV makes an urgent call to action. Congress and the VA must address glaring gaps in mental health care and drastically improve suicide prevention efforts among women veterans. For example, a common factor contributing to suicide risk among women veterans is military sexual trauma, or MST, which includes assault and harassment. Among veterans enrolled in VA care, an astounding 1 in 3 women report having experienced MST. The VA recognizes that MST is an independent risk factor for suicide and is associated with other mental health diagnoses, such as post-traumatic stress disorder, that are linked to additional increased risks for suicidal thoughts and behavior. Yet the VA's go-to model for predicting suicidality and intervening with high-risk veterans does not even take MST into account. How can this model effectively serve a population in which an estimated 1/3 has experienced sexual trauma? Simply put, it can't. Such oversights will inevitably fail to prevent suicide among women veterans. Additional factors that put women veterans at risk include high rates of intimate partner violence, substance use disorder, pregnancy in which the mother has pre-existing mental health conditions, as many women veterans do, and menopause. The VA must fully incorporate the experiences of women veterans into its suicide prevention efforts and the mental health care it provides, as well as address barriers in accessing gender-specific care. DAV's report makes over 50 potentially life-saving recommendations that offer a roadmap to that end. They include make MST a central pillar of suicide prevention efforts within the VA, require VA contracted providers, including maternity care providers, be trained in suicide prevention and issues affecting women veterans, create a three-digit number with a veteran option for the National Domestic Violence Hotline, assess the need for more women veterans specific residential rehabilitation programs for substance abuse disorder. We all sign up to serve, knowing sacrifices will be demanded. We understand we may have to put our bodies and our lives on the line. And we trust that when we return, we will get the care we deserve and earned. I implore Congress and the VA to consider DAV's recommendations and to act quickly. And again, this was written by Kim Hubers, who is a service-disabled South Dakota Army National Guard veteran of the Iraq War, a life member of DAV, commander of DAV Chapter 1 in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and a member of the DAV Interim Women's Veterans Advisory Committee. Now, a reminder that you are listening to the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on IRWIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRWIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. If you have any comments on this or any other IRWIS program, please give us a call at area code 515-243-6833. Now it's time to move on to today's obituaries. And first, we remember Margaret Helen Elgin Krawczyk, age 76, of Loveland, Colorado, and formerly of Dubuque, Iowa, who transitioned peacefully on Saturday, February the 17th, where she was surrounded by her family in prayer. Services will be held on Saturday, April 27th at St. Raphael's Cathedral, 10:30 a.m., 231 Bluff Street in Dubuque, Iowa. Margaret was born on November 17, 1947, in Fairley, Iowa, to Peter and Florine Elgin. She was baptized at St. Clement Catholic Church in Bankston, Iowa, where she attended primary school. She then went on to St. Joseph's of Fairley, Iowa, for secondary schooling. After graduation, Margaret followed her calling and joined the Sisters of the Presentation. Upon leaving the convent where she began her teaching career, Margaret met and married her lifelong partner of 50 years, Ferdinand Walter Krawczyk, and had three children, Melissa, Matthew, and Emily. While teaching, Margaret went on to receive her master's degree in religion from Loyola University in the New Orleans LIMEX Project. She taught for many years in the Catholic school system in various capacities, with her longest tenure at Wallert Catholic High School in both English and religion departments. Margaret went to work for the Archdiocese before retiring and moving to Colorado to be closer to her children and grandchildren. Next, we remember Edna M. Houselog of Dubuque, Iowa, who passed away peacefully on Sunday, April the 21st, at the age of 92. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. on Friday, April the 26th at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road in Dubuque, Iowa, where there will be a wake service at 3:45 p.m. Mass of Christian burial will be at 10 a.m. on Saturday, April the 27th, 2024 at St. Joseph's Church, Key West, with Monsignor Thomas Toll officiating. The burial will follow at Mount Olivet Cemetery. She was born on April the 3rd, 1932, in Dubuque, daughter of Joseph F. and Mary M. Rinker. On February 7th, 1953, she married her high school love, Ronald L. Houselog, at St. Mary's Church of Dubuque. They shared 61 years of marriage and six children. She spent her days reading, doing crossword puzzles and jigsaw puzzles, enjoyed knitting and crocheting, especially all things for babies. The family would like to thank Hospice of Dubuque and Hawkeye Care Facility for their care and compassion during this difficult time. Now we remember Donna M. Schmidt, age 75, of Durango, Iowa, who passed away Saturday, April the 20th at 2:40 p.m. at the Hawkeye Care Center, surrounded by her loving family after battling health issues for the last year. Mass of Christian burial will be at 10:30 a.m. Friday, April the 26th at Holy Spirit Parish, Holy Ghost Catholic Church, Dubuque, Iowa, with Father Stephen Garner officiating. A visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, April the 25th at Leonard Funeral Home Dubuque and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road, Iowa, with a wake service at 3:45 p.m. Donna was born on the family farm June 22, 1948, to Clarence and Emma Schultz of Holy Cross. She graduated from Leo High School in 1967, and on September 23, 1967, she married Robert Schmidt at the Holy Cross Church. Robert and Donna lived in North Buena Vista for many years before moving to Dubuque and then to Durango. Donna worked at Flex Steel Industries for over 30 years and worked part-time at ITC in Piasta. Donna was a very hard worker from a young age, working on the farm to raising chickens after getting married. She enjoyed playing softball for the Holy Cross Town Team with her sisters. She loved cutting grass, gardening outside, camping, quilting, and playing cards with her family and friends. Now we remember Jerome J. Yeager, age 96, of Dubuque, who died Sunday, April the 21st at the Stonehill Care Center in Dubuque. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday, April the 24th at Hoffman, Schneider & Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory. The Mass of Christian Burial for Jerome will be 10:30 a.m. Thursday, April the 25th at Holy Spirit Parish, Holy Ghost Catholic Church with Father Steve Garner as the celebrant. Burial will be in Mount Calvary Cemetery in Dubuque. Full military honors will be rendered by American Legion Post No. 6 and the Iowa Army National Guard. Jerome was born on March 20, 1928 in Balltown, Iowa, the son of Anthony and Mildred Yeager. On May 2, 1953, he married Donna Mae Hansen at Holy Ghost Catholic Church in Dubuque. Jerome was a U.S. Army veteran serving during the Korean War from February 8, 1951 until January 24, 1953. He was very proud to have been able to serve his country. Jerome worked as a supervisor at John Deere Dubuque Works for 36 years, retiring in 1982. He loved fishing, hunting, and gardening. His favorite pastime was sitting on his glider in the garage and waving to people as they passed by. Above all, Jerome was so very proud of his grandchildren and great-grandchildren. They were the light of his life. In lieu of flowers, a memorial has been established. The family would like to extend a special thank you to the nurses and staff at Stonehill and Hospice of Dubuque for their loving care. Condolences can be sent to the family by visiting Jerome's obituary at www.hskfhcares.com. Now we remember Richard Rick James Hocking of Galena, Illinois, who passed away unexpectedly on January the 9th with his family by his side. A funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, April 27th, 2024, at the Furlong Funeral Chapel in Galena, where friends may call after 9 a.m. until the time of service. Burial will be at a later date. He was born on October 8th, 1958, in Hazel Green, Wisconsin, the son of William and Norma Hocking. Rick attended Galena High School and graduated with a class in 1977. He attended the University of Dubuque, where he graduated with his Bachelor of Science in Business Administration and Economics. Rick was well known for being an exceptional football player while attending UD. He married his wife of 36 years, Mary Virtue, on May 30, 1987, in Galena. Rick worked for 36 years as an accountant, bookkeeper, and controller for several local businesses, including the DeSoto House Hotel, Coyote Exhibits and Design, Sproul Construction, Renaissance Restoration, and the Northwest Illinois Special Education Cooperative. He was most proud of his two children and spent time with his family in Keosauqua, Iowa. Rick was always there when people needed help and had a memorable laughter that will never be forgotten. Instead of flowers, memorials may be given to the Galena EMS in memory of Rick. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.furlongfuneralchapel.com. Now we remember Lucy Steffens, age 95, of Dubuque, Iowa, who passed away peacefully on April the 19th, 2024, at Hawkeye Care Facility. Lucy was born on December 1st, 1928, in Dubuque, daughter of Gladys and Anthony Pino. She married Ike Lasoya Sr. in 1948, and from this union, two sons were born. Lucy spent her early years working at the Dubuque Packing Company and raising her two beloved sons, along with anyone else who may needed a place to live until they could get back on their feet. Her kindness had no boundaries. She had a passion for the spiritual and psychic world, was an animal lover, especially her cats, and loved fishing with her grandsons. Per her wishes, no services will be held. Memorials may be made to a local humane society in Lucy's name. Online condolences and memories may be shared with the family at www.iowacremation.com. Now we remember Janet R. Brewer, age 58, of Cassville, Wisconsin, who died on Saturday, April the 20th, 2024. Visitation will be held from 9 to 11 a.m. Saturday, April 27th at St. Charles Borromeo Catholic Church in Cassville, where a Mass of Christian burial will follow. Burial will take place in St. Mary's Settlement Cemetery in Cassville. Martin Schwartz Funeral Home and Crematory of Cassville is assisting the family. And we remember Karen M. Smith, age 77, of Monticello, Iowa, who died on Sunday, April 14th, 2024. Visitation will be held from 10 a.m. to noon, Friday, April the 26th, at Rife Funeral Home in Epworth, followed by services at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Epworth. Burial will take place in the church cemetery. And finally, we remember Barbara J. Glasgow Burroughs, age 86, of Galena, who died on Monday, April the 22nd, 2024. Arrangements are pending. Miller Funeral Home of East Dubuque is assisting the family. Now it's time to move on to the sports page, and we'll start with what's on television today. In Major League Baseball, we've got the Brewers at the Pirates at 5:40 p.m. on Bally Sports Wisconsin. Athletics at Yankees at 6:05 p.m. on Amazon Prime Video. White Sox at Twins at 6:40 p.m. on NBC Sports Chicago. And Astros at Cubs at 6:40 p.m. on the Marquee Sports Network. In the National Hockey League's playoffs, the Bruins are at the Maple Leafs at 6 p.m. on ESPN. The Golden Knights are at the Stars at 8:30 p.m. on ESPN. And the Kings are at the Oilers at 9 p.m. on TBS. And then National Basketball playoffs, Heat at the Celtics at 6 p.m. on TNT or True TV. And the Pelicans at the Thunder at 8:30 p.m. on TNT or True TV. In college track and field, area athletes set for Drake Relays. Here's a list of area college qualifiers with their seeds for the Drake Relays, which kicks off this week at Drake Stadium in Des Moines. On the men's side, in the 800, we got number 8 Andrew Hutchinson of Dubuque. In the 1500, we got number 25 Ryan Harvey of Loras. The 110 hurdles, we've got number 10, Blake Hardison of Dubuque. The 400 hurdles, we've got JoJo Frost of Dubuque. The 4x100, number 9, Dubuque, 15, Loras, and 32, UW-Platteville. In the 4x200, number 13, Loras will participate. In the 4x400, number 9, Dubuque, number 16, Loras, and number 32, UW-Platteville. In the 4x800, number 8, Lawrence. In the distance medley, number 6, Dubuque, and number 9, Lawrence. In the long jump, number 8, Derek Bunton of Loras. In the high jump, number 4, Daniel Adams of Clark. And the triple jump, number 4, Jaden Williams of Dubuque. In the pole vault, number 8, Raymond Vanditti of Loras. In the discus, number 14, Holden Murphy of Lawrence. Number 33, McCade Jelinek of UW-Platteville. In the hammer throw, we've got number 11, Cade Collier of Dubuque, and number 35, Justin Eichler of UW-Platteville. And in the shot put, we've got number 7, Jacob Edwards of Dubuque. In the women's side, we've got 4x100, number 14, Loras, and number 31, UW-Platteville. The 4x200, number 18, Loras. In the 4x400, number 15, Loras, and number 31, UW-Platteville. In the 4x800, number 8, Loras. In the distance medley, number 8, Loras. In the long jump, number 11, Harmony Creasy of Loras, and number 12, Emma Seipel of Loras. In the high jump, we've got number 8, Jaden Gatz of Dubuque, number 15, Grace Alley of Loras, number 16, Sarah Hoskins of Loras. In the triple jump, we got number 13, Grace Alley of Loras. In the hammer throw, number 6, Caitlin Wilder of Dubuque. And in shot put, number 8, Caitlin Wilder of Dubuque. Our top story on the sports page is entitled, Powell Lifts Fighting Saints in Overtime. It's written by Jim Leitner. Noah Powell scored with 26.4 seconds remaining in overtime Tuesday night to lift the Dubuque Fighting Saints to a 2-1 victory at Youngstown in Game 3 of the USHL Eastern Conference semifinals. Dubuque took a 2-1 lead in the best-of-five series and can advance to the conference finals with a win tonight in Youngstown. Game 5, if necessary, would be Friday at Imon Arena. On the winning goal, Powell took a wrist shot from the left faceoff circle that hit the skate of a Youngstown player and fluttered into the air just over the outstretched glove of goaltender Aiden Wright. Wright appeared to lose sight of the puck after it hit the player's skate. Jaden Jubinville won a battle along the left wall to keep the puck in the Youngstown zone, and James Reeder collected it before cycling it to Powell for the shot. It was the first playoff goal for Powell, who led the USHL with 43 goals during the regular season. Earlier, Reeder broke a scoreless tie on a 4-on-3 power play goal with 6:27 remaining in regulation. Youngstown's Grant Young and Dubuque's Uri Petkarchik had already gone to the penalty box for coincidental roughing minors at the 12:06 mark when Phantoms captain Andrew Strathaman stripped Saints captain Jake Sondriel in front of the Phantoms' net at 13:08. On the ensuing 4-on-3, Juna Vason and Sondriel moved the puck around the perimeter before Sondriel found Lucas St. Louis in the right faceoff circle where he typically wires one-timers. Instead, St. Louis slid a backdoor pass to Reeder for a tap-in on Wright and his first goal of the playoffs. But the Phantoms tied the game with 1:42 to play in regulation. Ryan Botterill delivered a centering pass to Mikey Burchill on the right wing, and the former Saints forward, who requested a trade last offseason, snapped a shot past goalie Kevin Riedler for his second playoff goal. The play went to video review for goaltender interference before being confirmed by referees Chris Rumble and Dylan Sater. Youngstown enjoyed the first two power play opportunities of the game on a Michael Barron trip at 17:50 of the first period and an Eric Paulson trip at 2:21 of the second frame, but the Saints, who killed all five penalties in the first two games of the series in Dubuque, kept the Phantoms off the board. The Saints took their turn with a pair of power plays early in the second period, including 15 seconds of 5-on-3 play. Colson Hanrahan went to the box for roughing Colin Frank at the 8:19 mark, and Tomas Machu served a minor for slashing Reeder at the 10:04 mark. Youngstown killed both penalties, moving the UHSL's top regular season power play to just 1-for-15 in the series. In women's college basketball news, Caitlin Clark becomes the first two-time winner of the Sullivan Award. Caitlin Clark is still picking up trophies. The Iowa basketball star, who was recently the number one pick in the WNBA draft, won the James E. Sullivan Award for the second straight year Tuesday night. Clark is the first two-time winner in the award's 94-year history. It goes to the nation's most outstanding athlete at the college or Olympic level. Her high school coach, Kristen Meyer, accepted the award on her behalf at the New York Athletic Club. Clark gave her acceptance speech via Zoom. Voting by the public, the AAU Sullivan Award Committee, AAU Board of Directors, Sports Media, and previous winners decided the winner. The other finalists were Olympic wrestler David Taylor, Olympic speed skater Emery Lehman, gymnast Frederick Richard, Texas volleyball player Madison Skinner, and Paralympic swimmer Noah Jaffe. The award also honors leadership, citizenship, character, and sportsmanship on and off the playing field. The AAU Sullivan Award is an incredible honor, Clark said via Zoom. I have been inspired by so many athletes that came before me, and I hope I can be that same inspiration for the next generation to follow their dreams. She's been the main driver for the dramatic uptick in women's basketball interest with her mix of deep three-point shots, flashy thread-the-needle passes, and overall court presence. A women's basketball record 18.9 million viewers watched Iowa's loss to South Carolina in the NCAA title game and a WNBA record 2.45 million watched the draft. Caitlin has accomplished something no other athlete has done by being a two-time AAU Sullivan Award winner, and we couldn't be prouder, said Joe Mirza, AAU president. Beyond the court, her impact on women's basketball and women's sports in general cannot be overstated. She's an incredible role model for our AAU athletes. In baseball news, White Sox assign Harris. Former WD star joins advanced Class A Winston-Salem. This is also written by Jim Leitner of the Telegraph Herald. After spending the first 2.5 weeks of the season in Arizona at extended spring training to rehab a hand injury, Calvin Harris received his assignment from the Chicago White Sox this weekend. The former Western Dubuque All-State catcher and All-College World Series performer at the University of Mississippi was in the starting lineup Tuesday night for the Winston-Salem Dash in an advanced Class A South Atlantic League game against Rome. He joined the same league as Dubuque Wallert grad and Texas Ranger prospect Ian Moeller. Harris broke the hamate bone in his hand early in the White Sox minor league spring training camp and remained in Arizona for the start of the season while rehabbing from surgery. The White Sox delayed the start of his season until he reached 100%. In the local and area roundup, Hahn strikes out 19, Galena wins. Ava Hahn was nearly unhittable again on Tuesday. Hahn struck out 19 and allowed just 3 hits as Galena earned a 7-2 road victory over Stockton Warren. Hahn was 2-for-3 at the plate and allowed just 2 unearned runs. She issued 1 walk. Addie's Mitch went 4-for-4 with 3 doubles, 3 RBIs, and 2 runs. Emma Furlong was 3-for-3 with 2 doubles and 3 RBIs. Addie Baker was 2-for-3 for the Warhawks. East Dubuque 12, Southwestern 2 in 5 innings at East Dubuque. Kay Welp went 3-for-4 with 2 home runs for 4 runs and 4 RBIs as Curran Oberman had 3 hits, 2 RBIs, and 2 runs as the Warriors routed the Wildcats. Scales Mound / River Ridge 24, West Carroll 9 in 4 innings. This took place at Savannah, Illinois. Amy Richmond, Lakin Haas, Evelyn Waters, Sarah Winter, and Catherine Bilderback had 3 hits apiece. Haas and Bilderback each drove in 4 runs, and Richmond and Alyssa Wentz had 3 RBIs apiece as the Wildcats routed the Thunder. Pecatonica 8, Darlington 6 at Darlington, Wisconsin. Lily Ritchie went 3-for-4 at the plate, and Sophie Weigel, Ella Winslow, and Rainey Norgard had 2 hits apiece, but the Redbirds lost at home. High school baseball, East Dubuque 10, Fulton 9 in 8 innings. That was in East Dubuque, Illinois. Spencer Sindahl went 3-for-4 and hit a walk-off 2-run double as the Warriors rallied to beat the Streamers. John Poulton was 4-for-5. Angel Reyes drove in 3 runs, and Carver Kamentz struck out 10 in 6 innings for East Dubuque. Next, Galena 3, Warren Stockton 2 at Warren, Illinois. Owen Heffel and Mason Smith each drove in a run, and Heffel struck out 5 and allowed just 2 unearned runs on 5 hits and 3 walks in 6 innings as the Pirates edged the Warhawks. River Ridge / Scales Mound 19, West Carroll 1 in 4 innings at Savannah, Illinois. Ben Richmond had 2 hits, including a home run and 5 RBIs. George Winter scored 3 runs. Damon Dittmer drove in 3 runs. And Sam Reif and Mason Smith threw a combined no-hitter as the Wildcats ripped the Thunder. Darlington 5, Fenimore 4 in Fenimore, Wisconsin. Reagan Jackson went 3-for-3, finishing a triple shy of the cycle and earning the pitching victory as the Redbirds beat the Golden Eagles. And Cuba City 4, Riverdale 3 at Cuba City, Wisconsin. Andy Lefholtz had a double for one of the Cuba City's 5 hits, and the Cubans clipped Riverdale for an SWAL victory. In boys tennis, Dubuque Wallert 7, Cedar Rapids Prairie 2 at O'Connor Tennis Center. Charlie Curtis, Cal Martineau, Jensen Hill, Evan Anderson, and Chase Miller won singles matches as the Golden Eagles beat the Hawks for Coach Eric Lucy's 100th career victory. Cedar Falls 7, Dubuque Hempstead 2 at Roos Courts. Alec Bowman and Nolan Page won singles matches for the Mustangs, but the Tigers won the duel. In girls tennis, Cedar Falls 5, Dubuque Hempstead 4 at Cedar Falls. Maya Hoden, Clara Kelly, and Jordan Hancock won singles matches, and the doubles tandem of Kelly and Holden also won, but the Mustangs lost to the Tigers. Waterloo West 6, Dubuque Senior 3 at Meyer Courts. Liz Nielsen and Lauren Nemers won singles matches, and Nemers teamed up with Charlotte Mozina to win at number 3 doubles, but the Rams lost to the Warhawks. In boys soccer, Dubuque Hempstead 2, Waterloo West 1. At Timmerman Field, the Mustangs scored a pair of first-half goals before holding off the Warhawks to improve to 10-1, marking the program's most wins in a season since the 2015 team went 15-3. And Cedar Falls 3, Dubuque Senior 0 at Dalzell Field. The Tigers scored a pair of goals in the first half, then added an insurance score in the second to beat the Rams. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service, for the blind.